In the novel The Catcher in the Rye, author J.D. Salinger's protagonist says, "What really knocks me out is a book that when you're all done reading it, you wish the author that wrote it was a terrific friend of yours, and you could call him up on the phone whenever you felt like it." But you couldn't do that with Salinger himself. He was a famous recluse and a pillar of American fiction who detested the attention that came with literary fame. He probably would have hated the flowery obituaries that followed his death at the age of 91 this week in Cornish, New Hampshire. In our celebrity-soaked culture, where people dream of fame for the sake of fame alone, J.D. Salinger was the anti-celebrity. He walked away from autograph seekers. He had his fan mail burned. He took refuge from the phonies he wrote about. He lived on the other side of the world from Brangelina and from Octomom. While celebrity wannabes aspired to barge onto center stage through the gates of the White House, Salinger wanted nothing more than to slip out the back door. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye hero, Holden Caulfield, made a deep impression on me. I was flunking out of my junior year high school English class. He was flunking out of prep school. And boy, did I relate to his too-smart-for-his-own-good attitude when I was 16. And I admired the way Salinger was unapologetic about his decision to no longer have his work published. In one of the rare moments he did speak to the press, back in 1974, he told a New York Times reporter, quote, "I like to write. I love to write, but I write just for myself and my own pleasure." I don't expect to hear anything like that from anyone in my generation today. We spill our private lives across the internet in blogs, Twitter, and Facebook, and we expect our favorite actors and writers to do the same. We throw the door open wide, while Salinger wanted to just pull it more tightly shut. This week, Salinger's literary agent issued a statement saying that, in keeping with his lifelong, uncompromising desire to protect and defend his privacy, there will be no service. At last, Jerome David Salinger, you've found the privacy that you wanted in life. You're listening to NPR News. It may not have felt like it, but it turns out that the U.S. economy grew at a much faster pace during the last 3 months of 2009. The Commerce Department said yesterday that the nation's growth rate hit 5.7%, the fastest increase in 6 years. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, part of the surge was due to what economists call an inventory correction.
Last year turned out to be the worst year for the U.S. economy since 1946. It shrank by 2.4%. But here's the good news. The downturn occurred in the first half of the year. Lakshman Ashathan of the Economic Cycle Research Institute says growth was up sharply by the second half of the year, and he says the 5.7% growth rate during the last quarter means the economy entered this year on a pretty strong rebound.
Clearly, it's a good number. It shows that the recovery has been gaining speed as we have been debating whether or not it even exists.
There was an important qualification in yesterday's number. U.S. companies had cut back production so fast earlier in the year that by the fall they no longer had enough goods to sell, so they had to start churning out more products just to restock their shelves. Much of the increase in production was simply an effort to play catch-up, says Brian Bethune, chief U.S. financial economist at Global Insight.
Basically, they're producing at a higher rate than what they're selling, so that some of the product goes into inventories.
The problem is that companies won't keep producing at that same fast rate unless consumers and businesses increase their buying as well. There's some evidence that's already happening. Consumer spending was up at an annual rate of 2% during the fourth quarter. Business investment and exports were up. Achathan says that's good, but he says it won't make up for the damage that's been done to the economy over the past 2 years.
The problem is that we lost so much during this recession. We lost over 7 million jobs, a lot of GDP loss, a lot of wealth loss, and the amount of time it will take to recover that is going to be years.
There's also the worry that growth will slow down once federal government stimulus programs end. Still, Achathan says yesterday's report is clear evidence that the economy is mending. He describes the economy right now this way. It's like falling into the deep end of a swimming pool and kicking off from the bottom. You're traveling very quickly, he says, but there's that moment of anxiety about whether you'll reach the surface. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Well, one small silver lining of the recession may be that it underscored just how little some Americans understand personal finance. That presents a golden opportunity to change the way young people learn about money. And some credit unions want to play an increasing role in teaching that curriculum. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, Scott Graff reports.
A recent 10-year survey conducted by Finesse Financial found that 86% of Americans don't know if they're on track to retire comfortably, and 43% said they spend more than they make each month. People like Glenda Head are working to change those kind of stats. It's 11:30, and Head, a business teacher, is walking to the lunchroom at R.B. Glenn High School near Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Once there, she helps two of her students open the school's branch of a legacy federal credit union. It's one of four the nonprofit has started at area high schools.
They have to sign into a safe log where we sign in and out every day. So the beginning balance and the ending balance is confirmed.
Soon, the day's first customer, Jasmine, approaches the counter.
I'm withdrawing money from my account. $10 to be exact.
From savings, check-ins.
Make that 15.
One of the two tellers working today is 17-year-old Austin Dodd. He says the class that goes along with this hands-on experience is already paying off for him.
I'm actually saving up money now, and if I wouldn't have, I guess, got into this, I'd probably still be spending my money as soon as I get it.
Dodd and his classmates are introduced to things like credit scores, the stock market, and mortgages. Students are taught about ARMs versus fixed mortgages, why a 15-year is better than a 30, and the importance of making extra payments. Getting young people involved with credit unions is not a new idea. According to the Credit Union National Association, there were more than 700 branches in schools and youth clubs in 34 states last year. What has changed is the pace of growth. Since 2007, the number of these has increased by one-third.
Oh, student-run credit unions are fabulous.
That's Laura Levine, who heads the Washington, D.C.-based Jumpstart Coalition. Its mission is to get kids thinking about money matters as early as kindergarten. And her job is getting easier. She says the recession has sparked a dialogue about the importance of teaching kids a very basic life skill, one she says was once routinely taught.
We got away from some of the practical matters. I think we now realize that maybe we swung the pendulum a little too far away from the practical stuff.
While just about everyone who learns of the student-run credit union seems to like them, Sandy Wheat says they won't solve financial illiteracy. She's with the North Carolina Council on Economic Education and says the reality is that they're used by only a tiny fraction of high school students. And she says implementing such programs nationwide poses big challenges.
The idea of bringing in banking services to them is a little bit of a far-fetched notion when they're not even performing to grade-level expectations in their reading and math skills.
Wheat says funding the programs may be unrealistic at a time when school budgets are so tight. But she says the more young people can learn about money in school, the better their chances of avoiding the financial pitfalls facing so many adults today. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
If you believe 9/11 was an inside job, or that Neil Armstrong's moonwalk actually took place on a Hollywood set, or that a bunch of Jewish elders gathered in Europe at the end of the 19th century to plot the takeover of the world, well, this next story's for you. Because if you do, David Aronovich, a columnist for the Times of London, thinks you're at best deluded and at worst dangerous. He spent 6 years looking into the details behind some of the best-known conspiracy theories, and he set out to debunk all of them. The result is a book called Voodoo Histories, and David Aronovich says he got the idea while working on a BBC program in Tunisia.
And I had a very, very good young producer-director with me, a guy in his early 30s, very sensible. And we were having to drive down from Tunis to an amphitheatre. And on the drive, he just turned round to me and said, apropos of nothing, really, you know the moon landings? And I said, yes, I'd seen them as a kid on television. He said, well, you didn't. I said, what do you mean I didn't? He said, well, it didn't happen. And he then told me the thing which everybody gets told, you know, about the photographs that don't make any sense and the stars that aren't there and the flag flapping in the non-existent breeze and so on, all of which was conclusive evidence, he said, that this moon landing hadn't taken place.
And this was an otherwise reasonable guy. I mean, he wasn't sort of a wacko. He wasn't out there.
absolutely not a wacko at all. And the notion that a large number of people who believe in conspiracy theories are just wackos, I think just simply doesn't fit. I mean, really what this book is about is why perfectly intelligent people can believe perfectly ridiculous things.
Let me ask you about the famous document known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. This supposedly is of a meeting of Jewish bankers and other powerful figures in Europe at the end of the 19th century. They're planning to take over the world. People believed this then, and in many parts of the world, people still do, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we now kind of would regard such a theory, I think most of us, as being utterly ludicrous. But in 1920, my own newspaper, The Times of London, and what more prestigious paper could you get, at least it was until I worked for it, had an editorial which said, look at this pamphlet, it raises these incredibly disturbing questions, and then said about the First World War, have we fallen out of the Pax, escaped the Pax Germanica, in other words, the prospect of a German victory, only to find ourselves in a Pax Judaica? Now, it's about a year later that the Times redeems itself a bit, because it's its correspondent in Constantinople that discovers that the original book for the Protocols is in fact a French book from the 1860s. And this has just been lifted, key passages taken out, the words Jews, you know, we Jews, and this is what we're going to do, put in, and then circulated around Europe in the period after the First World War. And we know the consequences that that led to in terms of it being so widely believed, particularly in Germany. And as you quite correctly say, the Protocols are still now widely cited in the Middle East.
And you describe how in some of your travels in the Middle East, you see it all over the place, in bookstores and bookshops, and it's just sort of regarded as a normal historical document.
Totally normal, and it has a parallel with 9/11 theory. If you are to travel in Pakistan, for instance, you will find that the significant proportion of the educated Pakistanis, including the military class, believe fundamentally that George Bush brought down the Twin Towers, that it was an inside job. And that makes dealing with, let's say, the Pakistani Taliban quite difficult for them, because they actually fundamentally don't believe the premise upon which the battle against terror was waged. And quite often, what they will cite in these circumstances in support of their theories, journalists, academics and others, are theories that have been come up with in America, in Europe and so on, and they cite them as authority.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, because the former Malaysian leader, Mahathir Mohamad, recently said this publicly, that 9/11 was carried out by Zionist elements and so on. There are many people in this country, in the United States, who believe that 9/11 was an inside job. How did you go about debunking those claims?
Mahathir Mohamad, incidentally, also said that one of the key signs that it could be done was the making of the movie Avatar, if you remember. In other words, if you were clever enough to make the movie Avatar, then you were clever enough to do 9/11. And he also effectively said something really kind of rather insulting, which is that the Arabs, in a sense, weren't well organised enough to do something like that. The thing about dealing with conspiracy theories is you can't just assume right from the beginning that any conspiracy theory is automatically wrong because it seems to violate common sense. I mean, you're absolutely right. You have to go back to first principles and say, what is the evidence for this?
David Aronovich, I'm wondering if the belief in conspiracies today have real-world consequences. I mean, why should we take them seriously?
I talk about quite a lot of conspiracy theories in the book, and some of them actually are not that damaging. It's really not so terrible if people look at the front of the Da Vinci Code, where Dan Brown tells you that the Priory of Zion is real, which of course it isn't. It was invented in 1956. Nobody's going to die as a result of that, although I gather it has been fairly irritating for people in some French cathedrals and so on as a consequence of tourists coming up and asking them about it. But when you get something like the 9/11 story, the Protocols, or its latter version, which is that the Zionists, or a kind of super version of the Jewish lobby, is continuously operating, these things actually do have real-world consequences. I mean, it allows the people who may have bear some responsibility for some of these events to evade that responsibility by suggesting that it's conspiracies. Look, for instance, at the way in which the Iranian government deployed the notion that it was the British and the Americans behind their demonstrations. Now, this just in the last couple of weeks, they have begun executing people who were involved in the demonstrations in Tehran. And one of the elements that allows them to do that is this, if you like, this conspiracy theory element.
Before I let you go, a question for you. Aren't you part of the conspiracy, you know, given that given that you work for the establishment media?
I've had this said to me on a number of occasions. After a discussion in London about the book, this guy came up to me afterwards, one of the 9/11 truth people. He looked me in the eyes and he said, "Why are you doing this?" And I had to say, look, you know, I've done the work on this. This is what I think to be true. But of course, it's exactly what a lot of people in the conspiracist movements are going to say. It's just one of them. I mean, look at his name.
David Aronovich is a journalist and author. His new book is called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. David Aronovich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can find more conspiracy theories and David Aronovich's list of the characteristics that help them spread. That's at our website, npr.org. We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and this week, the president hoped to hit the reset button.
Neither party should delay or obstruct every single bill just because they can.
There are issues and items that we do agree upon, but when they're lumped together in 2,000-page bills, typically what we find is a lot of things that we disagree with.
House Minority Leader John Boehner and earlier President Obama. James Fallows joins me here in the studio for a look at the week that was. And Jim, thanks for trudging through the snow here in Washington today.
My pleasure. It's nice and brisk outside.
On your blog this week, Jim, you write that normally State of the Union addresses are more like corporate annual reports than normal speeches. But you also wrote that you think this one, this past week, will actually be studied by historians closely.
Well, sort of. State of the Union addresses usually have two impacts. One is in real time. It's the main guaranteed audience the president has over TV in the course of a year, so he makes his case. The other is they're studied in budgetary terms, because usually you go through and you have one sentence about each department of the government. I think this one, its main effect was its consistency with other big speeches Obama has given in sort of resetting his situation, recovering from political setbacks and saying, here's the way he would like to redefine, whether it's the deficit argument, the partisanship argument, the healthcare argument, or so on.
Now, Jim, no matter what anyone might think about President Obama, it was still pretty remarkable to watch him address those House Republicans in Baltimore yesterday. He was basically going into enemy territory. He took questions for 90 minutes, and it was all televised. I can't remember another example of a president doing this.
Nor can I. And I think the closest counterpart is something that was not only not televised but secret for a long time, which are the transcriptions of Lyndon Johnson's telephone calls, which were released a few years ago. And you could hear the same sort of playing the great organ of working on people with emotional appeals and logical appeals and all the rest. And Obama, of course, was doing this in live TV with a national audience in his enemy's camp. And I think that in retrospect, I think it would be good for the nation if there could be many more of these. I will be surprised if the Republican Party accepts many more of these invitations, because I think on net it was a more impressive performance for the president in trying to present his personality and his arguments than it was for the other side.
I mean, even though presumably some of the House members there will try and use their confrontations with the president in their reelection campaigns.
That's certainly so. And I think we saw in this session, this remarkable session, the built-in advantage any incumbent president always has, that he was the center of every discussion, and these people were asking questions from the twilight or not really on camera. He could be there calm and confidently sort of giving his answer. So it is a plus that any president has, and it's a particular form that favors President Obama.
Jim, turning on to a completely different topic, last night China announced that it's suspending some military exchanges with the United States because of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. This issue seems to come up every year or so, and then it seems to just blow over and pass on. Is it different this time?
I think it is different in some ways. It comes up every year or every couple of years because when the U.S. normalized its relations with mainland China and changed them with Taiwan 30-plus years ago, it committed itself to a kind of ongoing arms relationship with the Taiwanese, which is a constant irritant in mainland China. And so every time this happens, there's complaint from the government in Beijing, which is barely noticed by most of the populace in the U.S., but a big deal in China. This time, it may be more because so many other things are sort of breaking in the direction of U.S.-China friction right now. The Google case, of course, is only becoming more sort of embattled in China. There's issues about currency levels and trade imbalances, and of course, the Copenhagen agreements, where China and the U.S. Were in disagreement there.
And the U.S. is now saying it will reduce its CO2 emissions by some 17% over the next decade, part of this Copenhagen Accord that was discussed last month at the U.N. Climate Change Conference. China, of course, is the world's largest producer of greenhouse gases. Well, what's the sense? Will China sign on to this?
I think in the long term, it is necessary for China to be involved in this sort of agreement because otherwise there really isn't any hope of coping with it. In the short term, I think we'll know in basically 2 days whether or not China is willing to match this U.S. announcement with something of its own, because that was the period after the Copenhagen talks when all the major parties were supposed to say, okay, what are you doing next? If they don't do that, it means another sort of long slogging round ahead.
What are the Chinese objections?
Chinese objections are essentially you Western powers, for 200 years, you've had a free run on polluting the world, and anyway, you're still much richer than we are. So why should we, just beginning to develop with all these peasants and poor people, why should we make these sacrifices now? That's their case.
And Jim, one more thing before we let you go.
Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Every year, Jim, I should mention, you post an annotated version of the State of the Union address, and this year you did as well. And I was hoping you could explain what it is about that line we just heard that drives you up the wall.
What drives me up the wall is that before the era of Ronald Reagan, who changed America in ways both better and worse, presidents, when they ended an address on any topic, they had to end it with an actual ending. They had to complete their thought. They had to say what they wanted people to do or change their behavior or whatever. Abraham Lincoln did that. You can check it out. George Washington did it. Thomas Jefferson did it. Everybody did it until Ronald Reagan, who began the practice of ending all of his addresses with, "And God bless the United States of America." That's a fine sentiment. I agree with it myself. But as a way to end a speech, it's become the equivalent of a flag pin that on your lapel.
Yeah.
That is, you have to do it, otherwise you're somehow not American. So I fruitlessly and vainly lament its appearance every time it comes up.
That's James Fellows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can read his annotated State of the Union at jamesfellows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much, and God bless America.
And God bless us, everyone.